And good morning. It is 7:08 on WCCO. We know that song. We know it's time for our car care segment with Nick Stoffel from Lloyd's Automotive in St. Paul. If you have a question for Nick, anything car related, that's why he's here. 651-461-9226. You can call us on that number. You can text us on that number. 651-461-9226. Good morning, Nick. How you doing?
Doing well. How are you doing, Laura?
I'm doing okay. You know, I'm a little challenged this morning where I'm doing that thing that I swore I would never do, and that is looking over the top of my glasses to try to read the text line and then pushing them back up so I can see the clock or Candace, who are farther away from me. I'm having that whole bifocal challenge trying to figure these glasses out this morning. But I'll get it. Sometimes it works better just to take them off and be in a hazy fog and just deal with it.
Well, I have the opposite with my cheaters. I always wear them around my neck, and then I'm trying to look and see, then I forget that I have them. And the one of the benefits of getting older, I guess.
Yeah, old age challenges for sure. We'll make it through. If you have a question for Nick this morning, anything car related, 651-461-9226. You can call us, you can text us, whatever you'd like to do. Nick, I wanted to ask you a little bit about a topic I saw online this week about basic car maintenance for beginners, whether that's a beginner driver or somebody with their first car that is not something their parents bought for them. Some of the things that they should be checking every month and then like every couple of months, and what some of those milestones are for making sure they're staying up to date with their maintenance. And of course, there's the obvious ones like checking your oil and tire pressure and that kind of thing. But what comes to mind for you that a beginner should know if maybe they're having their first car and trying to do this on their own without daddy bugging them that it's time to get their car in or check their oil?
Well, I think it's really for all of us. I think that the years when even most of us father figures knew a lot more about cars and just things in general, I think technology's changed so much that it's hard to know how and what to do a lot of things when it comes to just not just our vehicles but anything. And that kind of brings me to a topic too, where I kind of want to touch base on, you know, looking at fuel prices. You know, you're a young driver, you're a new driver, for all of us that matter, the gas prices haven't dropped, and who knows when they will. So it makes you think about fuel economy and how can we affect that? What are the little things? And there's not an easy button. You can't say if you do this one thing, you're going to get magically way better fuel economy. However, if you do little things, if your tire pressures are inflated to the proper level, inside the driver's door, there's a placard at the base of the door that'll tell you the PSI at cold, meaning if you check your tire pressures on the cold before it's been driven, that's the minimum pressure it should be. Usually I tell you to go a couple PSI higher, just a good safe landing zone. The air filter, when's the last time the air filter was replaced? Let's allow that engine to breathe. Let's not choke it out. Or give it good, clean, fresh air so it can make combustion at an efficient rate. The tune-up, as we used to call it, which is essentially spark plugs and a few other things, there's a mileage interval for spark plugs. When's the last time they were done? Oil, you know, same kind of follow the same path there. So there's a lot of little things we can do that can affect the maintenance and the fuel economy of a vehicle. So if you're thinking, it seems like it just slipped a little bit, some of these little things do add up to maybe a measurable amount of a fuel economy, especially when gas prices are up over $4 a gallon.
Yeah, right. We do have a texter on the line here, Nick, and it's a little difficult to read. This is a long question, and if you have a big question like this one, call us. It's a lot easier. 651-461-9226, but I'll try to make my way through the text here. Okay. This has to do with replacing rotors that are not covered by warranty. This person doesn't want to throw good money after bad on their guess of what the problem might be. It sounds like the brakes are pulsing more so when stopping from higher speeds. The dealership acknowledges the issue but doesn't quite know why. So I guess it's the dealership talking about the rotors, and this person wants to know if it's something that they should be investing money in. What do you think?
Well, brake pulsation is a common concern people have, and it's a result of the brake's rotor being warped. Causes of that can be excessive heat, meaning if you're more of an aggressive driver, coming off the highway, that brake caliper squeezing those brake pads on the rotor over a period of time, that's going to heat up and distort the surface of the rotor, making it warp. When it warps, it becomes uneven. And when we apply our brakes in those situations, the rotor is kind of bouncing off those brake pads, which results in the caliper taking that that impulse, and then that brake fluid sends it back to the brake pedal, which you feel. So you're applying the brakes to the you're applying the brake pedal, you're sending the hydraulic fluid through the system to the calipers ultimately. If those rotors are warped, it's going to have a pulsation that you're going to feel. Now, when we do a brake job, we need to ensure that if we're, you know, replacing the rotors, but also the mounting surface, that hub area where that rotor rides, is that area clean and smooth from any corrosion, any debris, any gunk? You got to take that, make that a good, flat, clean surface, because if you have any imperfection there, you're taking a flat rotor, applying it to an imperfected area, you clamp it all down, well, you're going to create a warping situation that way also. So that's one area I think we see when people do replace the brakes, that we don't take the extra time to make sure that that mounting surface, that mating surface where the rotor rides, is very clean. So that's a big one there. And then also when you replace the pads, you need to do a very good thorough job of cleaning the caliper area, the slides that the pads ride in, because we want those slides to move smoothly back and forth. If they're hanging up at all, they're sticking at all, it's going to cause a little bit of drag, which is heat. And once again, that heat results in the brake rotor becoming warped. So it's not that you're doing something wrong, but when we do these services, we need to be thorough. So therefore, when the job's completed, you have a properly working brake system.
Great. Wow.
More, a little more information than we wanted, but
that's good. Well, very detailed. Good stuff. It is 7:15 on CCO. If you have a car-related question for Nick Stoffel from Lloyd's Automotive in St. Paul, give us a call, give us a text, 651-461-9226, 651-461-9226. A couple of questions on the text line. We'll get to them after the break right here on CCO. All right. We are waking up. It is 7:18 on WCCO. I'm Laura. I'm here with Candace, and we're here with Nick Stoffel from Lloyd's Automotive in St. Paul, taking your car care questions for about another 25, 28 minutes or so. So get them in, 651-461-9226. If you'd like to call us, that's great. If you'd like to text, that's fine too, but we'd really love some more calls. 651-461-9226. Candace, looks like we do have a caller. Who do we have?
Terry from Delano.
Hi, Terry. Thanks for calling in. What's your question for Nick?
I've got a Chevy 27-2500 HD Duramax pickup truck, and I'm having trouble with brakes squealing. It's not the wear bar grinding. I had the front brakes redone, and calipers, pads, and the rotors, the whole nine yards, and it's still doing a squealing noise, which means it must be from the rear. But it's not consistent. It only happens when it comes to just about a stop. And I get a loud squealing, and it's not always happening. It just seems like it's a temperature thing sometimes. But it's a loud squealing, screeching noise, not a grinding noise like the wear bar would be. I know what that would sound like. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas on that as far as what could possibly be causing that to squeal like that.
Yeah, there's a couple good points you made there. You mentioned maybe it's temperature related. It's coming just to a stop at the very end. My truck is a 2025, and I don't know, there's 30 some thousand miles on it. And I experience something similar from time to time, and it drives me nuts. And you had the fronts done, so then you automatically going to assume it's the rears. The hardest part and the most frustrating part for us as the shop is we got to figure out which wheel it's coming from. We'd like to assume it's just the rear because the fronts are new, but there could be an imperfection in the pad. You mentioned calipers, rotors. You did the whole ball of wax, that maybe there's an imperfection in one of those also. So the first thing that needs to be confirmed is which corner of the vehicle is the noise coming from. The fact that it's intermittent can be frustrating. The first thing I ask of you is try to make some notes. You've got some good ones already, but what can the shop do to experience the noise? Therefore, when you bring it in and say, hey, if you go drive down this or do that or however it is to recreate that situation, they can do that and experience that. And it is possible, kind of what we touched on earlier, even with those new brakes, if there's a space that wasn't lubricated or cleaned properly, there could be some resonating noise, and that noise amplifies, and that's what you hear when you apply those brakes. So I wouldn't, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the new brakes, but I would make sure that they double check that work and make sure everything has been properly cleaned and lubricated. I feel if you stick with them, if there's something with the rear, if they can pinpoint, find any kind of wear mark, that might be a good clue also. So just be patient. Try to figure out which corner the vehicle's coming from. Document what they can do to try to test drive and experience the same noise. Bring that into the shop. Have them do exactly as you described. Hopefully get to the bottom of it and get it resolved for you.
All righty. Thank you for the call, Terry. The text line is blowing up, Nick. We have quite a few questions here, so let's try to get through as many as we can in the next few minutes. First texter says, how long will a small battery last on a Toyota Highlander hybrid?
Well, the 12-volt battery is going to vary a lot on our driving habits. You know, the 12-volt battery is the same concept in all vehicles, but sometimes the capacity and the size will vary on the vehicle. So a lot of the smaller vehicles on the road today might have a smaller sized, physically smaller sized battery, which means the capacity can change. So I'd like to say, you know, it's not unheard to see a battery go bad in 3 years. I'd like to say 4 or 5, depends on your driving habits, make and model, but I think 4 or 5 is a good time frame. When you're going for your service this fall here, August, September, October, you definitely need to have them test that 12-volt battery, make sure it's got good coverage and good capacity to get you through the winter.
Very good. Next question from a texter. Are the air filter and cabin filter the same thing?
Good question. They both clean air, but the engine air filter cleans the air going into the engine for combustion. And the cabin filter is just for that's for the cabin of the vehicle. So when you turn on the heating and cooling system, whether it's the air conditioning or it's the heat in the winter months, you're pulling that air from the outside. It's going to filter that air before it comes into the cabin of the vehicle.
Okay, so two different filters.
Two different filters.
Gotcha. Okay. Would like to know, when I change oil at my 5,000-mile interval while in my Chevy, why is the oil much darker than in my Toyota? I presume that it is still working at that mileage.
I think the mileage is the correct mileage. Make sure you're using a good quality oil, a good quality filter. It depends on the age of the vehicle. No two vehicles are alike, in meaning that, you know, sometimes we'll notice that engine oil, transmission fluids, some of these fluids, even though they're being maintained, they might have collected some carbon or some debris to change the color of it. If it's getting worse, if you're concerned, maybe shorten the interval a little bit. You know, I wouldn't go way overboard with it, but as long as you're following the interval, it should be just fine.
Great. Next question. Have new tires installed last week and this week, still feeling a little bit of shaking or vibration in my steering wheel. Any ideas?
Well, I would take it back, have them rotate the tires, see if it changes. You know, we always want to try to isolate a sensation, a noise we're feeling. And in order to do that, sometimes we have to change something. So the tires are new. Well, it can't be the tires. Well, maybe one of the rims is slightly bent. You know, they do balance them, but maybe it's a little bit more than can be balanced out. So try rotating those tires around. Go from the front to the rear. If you notice that vibration goes altogether gone, well, then you know one of those front wheels is slightly out of round. It's on the rear of the vehicle. Or if it feels like it's going from the steering wheel to the seat of the vehicle, same idea. You know something has changed, so you can kind of isolate the source of it.
Good. If you have a question for Nick, give us a call, give us a text. The number is the same, 651-461-9226, 651-461-9226. Back to the text line. Nick, we have a 2016 Honda Pilot and would like to get a trailer hitch installed. Is it okay to do, and is it hard to do?
Well, there's a lot of providers of those receivers that we install, and oftentimes they're designed for a vehicle by year, make, and model, which is really nice. It might be a little bit more than do-it-yourselfer, because sometimes you have to remove the bumper cover or pull the exhaust down to get it fitted up into the right position. But once those things are out of the way, it's usually just a few bolts or fasteners that hold it in place. I think the real challenge comes into whether or not your vehicle is equipped with the wiring. If you're looking for that hitch just to put a bike rack on, no worries there. But if you're trying to pull a utility trailer with lighting, you have to make sure somebody wires that up so you have the proper operation once you're trying to pull that trailer.
So all hitches are not the same.
No, they're going to be by make, model. You know, long time ago, we tried to make things fit, but no, they've come a long ways where they're really durable, very reliable. The instructions are very good. It's just a matter of taking the time to, you know, work your way through those few challenges.
Gotcha. Next question. I have a 2009 Nissan Murano with suspected rear suspension issues. There's a clunking noise when going over bumps. Seems like much less noise when the Murano is loaded or has weight in the rear. Any ideas as to what to investigate?
Well, it's a good clue there. So when we have weight in the back, we're taking up any slack or any free play, so that noise goes away. So we're thinking something with the shocks, a shock mount bushing, something that's constantly moving. Once we load it down, it's under pressure, so the noise isn't as bad. So I would look at those types of things that are affected by the load of the vehicle, weight bearing. Like I said, the shocks, the mounts would be probably the first area that I'd start.
Okay, good. Another brake question, Nick. I just had my Subaru's front brakes done. They resurfaced the rotors, like you were talking about. Is it possible that Subaru makes their rotors thicker than other car brands? And what do you think about that resurfacing of rotors?
So years ago, we used to resurface brake rotors versus replacing them. I would say that's one area that they, you know, the manufacturers are trying to control weight, rotating weight, mass, all these things. And brake rotors from when I was a kid were extremely heavy. You'd take two hands and you'd lug them over to the car. Now they're much more lightweight. The other thing that has changed also is that the brake pads have changed, where it used to be you'd get 20 or 30,000 miles outside of brakes. Now you make it two or three times that. You know, get 60, 70, 80,000 miles is not unheard of. But in knowing that, there's a lot more wear, a lot more heat just pushed through that brake rotor. So we've learned that the rotors are lighter weight, which means they're thinner. A lot of times you can measure them to see if there's any material left to be resurfaced. But at that point, you're even making the rotor thinner than it was. My experience would be after 60, 70, 80,000 miles, if you resurface those rotors, they're not going to make it through a second brake job. The cost of resurfacing the rotors is going to be a little bit less than replacing them, the parts themselves. But I think for the long run, the better process would be to replace the rotors when replacing those brake pads.
All right. Thank you very much. 2012 Ford Fusion that I love, but the salty roads are causing it to rust out. How do I find a similar car from a southern state so it won't have so much rust?
Well, you can obviously go online. There's a lot of those apps that have list vehicles. And buying any vehicle, it's local or a distant ways away, make sure you can have that inspected. Make sure a technician, a shop, a dealership, somebody kind of puts their hands and eyes on it to make sure you're getting as advertised. If you do buy that vehicle, you get it back into the state here over the winter months. We talk from time to time. On those good winter days, running through the car wash, I know the line might look long, but I do think that your car does appreciate it. You pay the extra dollar for the undercar spray, which really does help knock down all that salt and that stuff that, you know, they spray on the roads to keep that car from rusting and rotting away a little bit longer.
Great. Thank you very much. I have a question for you, Nick. And you brought up a little while ago just the issue of mileage when we were talking about rotors, either resurfacing them or replacing them. But it made me think, like, what is realistic these days for how much mileage we should be able to get out of our cars before they die or it's time to sell or trade? Is it still the thinking that a foreign-made car is going to last longer and you can put more miles on it than an American-made car? I know that kind of used to be the talk or the attitude. Has that changed, or what do we think?
You know, I think I don't think it whether it's domestic or an import makes much of a difference. It's really, I think the cars have evolved so much, it really kind of comes down to us, to be honest. How well do we maintain our vehicle?
Yeah.
Do we follow the maintenance interval? How often do we forget about the oil change? You know, we have all kinds of makes and models that come in that people have all a variety of experiences. You know, it really comes down to maintenance. I think the age of a vehicle, and I, don't quote me here, but I feel like they say the average age of a vehicle on the road is over 12 years old now. The cars are designed to go, I won't say forever, obviously, but for hundreds of thousands of miles. So, you know, if your car is 10, 15 years old, it's got 200,000 or 300,000 miles, and you're thinking, I'm ready for a new one, you've done a good job. You're ready for a new one. If you're saying, can I keep this one on the road? I would say, yes, you can. Now, where you start to get worried is like, well, we're driving across the country in my 15-year-old, 300,000-mile vehicle. Is it going to make it? Is it what people are going to ask me? And what we're going to say is, well, how well have you maintained it? And they say, well, I've been religiously following the schedule. I do the oil changes. I've done the tune-ups. I've done all the fluid services. I've done all these things to keep my car as good as I can. I would tell that person, yes, you should absolutely drive that car across the country. It's just as good as one half its age. On the other hand, if you're like, well, you know, I get in when I can. Well, there's more likely a potential issue for that vehicle. So it's not necessarily the make or the model. It's how well have we maintained that vehicle. So I think to say 200,000-300,000 miles, which is a large range, but that is very, very common on a car these days. 10, 15 years old, we see them all the time. So I would say you're not in need of a vehicle. If you're at the higher mileage, more years down the road, and you come across a significant repair, then you got to look at your budget and figure out what's the best plan for you and your family.
I'm sensing a lot of parents smiling with what you just said, where maybe their kid is driving a car that has, you know, 250,000 miles on it, and they worry about it. And now you're kind of saying, eh, you don't necessarily have to be worrying. That's a good thing. Good.
Well, and remember when we were kids, we got whatever vehicle we could get our hands on. And boy, had the world changed. The expectation of these kids and their cars is almost laughable.
Yeah, but I have one of those with quite the expectations. That is for sure. All righty, Nick, it is 7:32. We need to take a break. We are taking your calls and your questions for Nick Stoffel from Lloyd's Automotive in St. Paul, 651-461-9226. When we come back, we have a couple of texts we'll get through. One of them has to do with a tire pressure sensor. Another one from somebody who is losing a small amount of coolant. Whatever kind of question you have for Nick, now's the time. 651-461-9226. 732 on CCO. And it's 738 on WCCO. Thanks for waking up with us. We are talking with Nick Stoffel from Lloyd's Automotive in St. Paul, taking all of your car-related questions either by phone or by text. Get in touch, 651-461-9226. And Nick, I want to get back to the text line. I promised a couple of questions we'd get to here. One of them says, one of my tire pressure sensors failed. How easy is it to replace the sensor? I know sensors need to be programmed, but can I easily replace the actual sensor myself? What do you think?
Unfortunately, not likely. The sensors are at the base of the valve stem inside the wheel. So what we have to do is we remove the wheel from the vehicle. We have a machine that separates the tire from the wheel, gain access to the sensor and stem, install a new one, reinstall the tire, balance the tire back on the vehicle. So there's a bit of a process. It's not something somebody at home with basic tools can do. You know, and they do need to be initialized or programmed. And it's really funny that we'll have vehicles that seem like they've had the same sensors forever, or we've replaced one, or we replaced four. So there's a whole variety of options there. So just make sure that they check all four of them, or five, because sometimes a spare tire might have a sensor also. So check the status of the battery, make sure there's a good voltage reading on them, only replace what's necessary, and then hopefully keep yourself back on the road.
All right, good. Another question, 2025 Mazda CX-70 with 15,000 miles, 3.3 liter, loses small amount of coolant, no leaks, no vapor in the exhaust. Should I be concerned?
Well, you know, not overly concerned today. You know, keep in mind that the coolant is half water. It can evaporate a little bit when we say small amount. I think the best thing to do is... on a cold morning, look at that reservoir. If it's got a sight glass, we can see the level in there. Maybe take a picture or mark it somehow. Give it a period of time. Always check with the engine cold, because once the engine's been run, the cooling system heats up, it's under pressure, and it expands. When it expands, the level's going to adjust with that. So make sure it's the same time in the morning. The car sat overnight. It's definitely cooled down, depressurized. So therefore, you get an accurate level reading of the coolant. if it is getting low after a week, a month, however long it is, document exactly how much you're adding. So therefore, when you're in for service, you can say, hey, here's what I've been doing. I've been paying attention to this. I added a pint, I added a quart, whatever, over a period of time, gives the shop or the technician a kind of a couple clues to try to determine where that's going.
Okay, good. We just want to mention here while we have Nick with us for a few more minutes that we'd love to see you out at the State Fair with Nick on the very first Saturday of the fair, which is August 29th. He'll be with us live out at our WCCO radio booth starting at 7 a.m. So come see Nick in person. You can bring your questions. You can just come see what a cool guy he is and why we like him so much. Yeah.
Well, who knows about that? But no, wow. It's been a bit of a tradition. We've always come out the first Saturday of the fair, and hopefully, you know, I'm teenagers now, so they used to be excited to come with me. Now I'm not sure I can get them up, but we'll try.
Well, I bet you they'll come. It's pretty cool to see Dad up on the WCCO radio stage at the fair. That's a big deal. All righty. Another texter, Nick. Is there a formula or rule of thumb to calculate the effect of the number of passengers or extra weight on auto mileage? Kind of getting back to that fuel economy topic here. Talking about,
you know, you can look in the manual, it'll talk about capacity and load and all that. I don't know. I'm sure somebody that's really good at math can kind of figure that out, but I would say obviously don't overload a vehicle has its capacity. I think 99.9% of us live and run within that. You're going to the cabin, you're not going to have any issues, so I wouldn't go too far down that rabbit hole, I guess. But obviously the more weight in the vehicle can affect the fuel economy, so bring what you need. I don't think one extra handbag is going to make a difference. I think if the car is bloated to the gills and it's, you know, the bumper sitting on the ground per se, you know, obviously that might be a little different, but that's not very likely. I think for the most of us, it doesn't make much of a difference, to be honest.
Okay, good. Older Nissan Murano with ABS light and VDC light off illuminated. Suspect braking system control issues. Any suggestions?
So have that looked at. Anytime we have a warning that the ABS isn't functioning, that means anti-lock brakes. So if you get in a slippery situation, not just the winter, a wet road, a dirt road, any situation you need to maneuver quickly, you need the car on your side. You don't want to be fighting against the vehicle. Take it to the shop. They can access the computers. Retrieve a code that'll give them a description of an area of an issue. But go to that area and do some testing. You know, is there a sensor, a switch, some sort of component that's not working properly? And because of that, the computer system identifies that. So by default, it shuts the system off. So at least have it assessed, have it diagnosed, figure out what the options are. Then you can make an informed decision.
And let's go over again what you do at Lloyd's if somebody has a problem like this and they just want to get something checked out. Can you just check something out without making a big full appointment and having to, you know, commit to an actual procedure?
Well, you're not going to commit to a repair, but to properly diagnose a vehicle, you're going to have to access the computer, as I mentioned. You retrieve a code, and this is where the misleading information comes from time to time, where, well, you just plug it in and it tells you what's wrong. That's not true. You plug it in, it gives you a code of a symptom. There's a circuit failure, a voltage, an open, a short, something that the computer doesn't like. It's upon our expertise to take that code, figure out what part of the system, what part of the vehicle that might lie, and start doing some actual testing. So people often ask, does it cost to have a vehicle diagnosed? It does, but I also will say, if we're disassembling something to do some testing that's relevant to the repair, we're not going to charge you twice. Yeah. So you're not paying for the same procedure twice, but that time that the technician spends is time and money, and there is a cost associated with that.
Right, good. Good information as always, Nick, and thank you so much to the texters and callers. We had a good variety of questions this week. 744 on CCO. We'll chat next week with Nick at this time. Coming up, our weekly wine chat with Ted Farrell from Haskell's in a moment.